Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Wildfire is inevitable, and in some areas, it is necessary for forestry regeneration. But it can also threaten homes, businesses, and lives. The fire season started with a whimper this spring, but it has been roaring in recent weeks after thousands of lightning strikes in the interior. As the 4th of July approaches, what's the status of active fires across the state and the outlook for this season and the future? We'll hear from fire experts today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The governor released a disaster declaration for the Denali Borough last week because of the destruction of homes and other structures in the area. Temperatures in the 80s are forecast for the Fairbanks region this week. How concerned are fire managers about hot July weather in the interior and in other parts of the state? Here to give us an update on what firefighters will be contending with in coming days and how you can best help keep your property and your family safe is Beth Ipson. Beth is the Public Affairs Specialist with the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, Alaska Fire Service. Also on the line with us is Sam Harrell. Sam is the Information Officer with the Alaska Division of Forestry and Fire Protection. And Rick Thoman is also joining us. Rick is a Alaska and Arctic Climate Specialist with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at the International Arctic Research Center at UAF. Let's start off with a fire status update for the state. Sam, give us a description of the fires of concern today, where there may still be evacuations, and what other information folks should have right now.
You bet, Lori. Thanks for having us on today. This is very timely. There's numerous fires across the interior. Several of them are in the North Star Borough around Fairbanks. Fires out in Tok have evacuations affecting folks. Folks in the Denali Borough, the Bear Creek Fire, are also affected by evacuations. The fires have moderated here recently. We had some cooler, wetter weather after the warm, dry stretch that we had in June, early June, and then the middle of June, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, we had numerous thunderstorms full of lightning, frequent lightning all across the interior. And that's responsible for the spate of fires that we have out there now. We are expecting warm, dry, windy weather. There's a red flag warning was just announced, elevated from critical fire weather. This will be in effect for much of eastern Alaska and central interior Alaska tomorrow. So everybody needs to be ready and prepared and be paying attention to what's going on around them. Don't really anticipate the volume of thunderstorm and lightning that we had before, but it will be, it's that time of year. You know, we will have some thunderstorms and we will have some lightning. So people just need to be ready and pay attention to what's going on around them, especially with the holiday coming and folks wanting to get outdoors and enjoy Alaska.
Sam, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner reported late last week there is no official list yet of who lost homes in the Bear Creek Fire and the more remote St. George Fire, primarily because borough officials have been unable to get into the fire zone to confirm. It is still too dangerous, according to firefighting officials. Estimates are up to 17 structures are lost to fire. That was reported on June 26th. Is there a more recent update here? Are you more aware of what homes and structures may have been lost in those areas?
To get into those specifics, it really comes down to the borough. I do know, you know, when you throw that number 17 out there, that's not primary residences or cabins. That's a combination of residences, cabins, and then just outbuildings, be it a shed, be it an unattached garage, be it an outhouse in a remote cabin. So we really need to wait until the boroughs can get in and assess that. The Nally Borough did catch the brunt of it around the remote cabin community of Gold King, and then the communities along the Parks Highway north of Healy.
Are there areas where pilot cars are still being used? Should people expect delays on certain roads?
Through the Bear Creek fire area, because of work being done on the utilities there and just the movement of firefighters and fire equipment through the area, there are still pilot cars working, but it's not the delays that were before when it was active fire and smoke impacting the road. It's a little more consistent movement, taking a group north and then bringing another group south as utility crews are working in there. Power lines were affected. Communication lines were affected. Things that weren't buried were damaged up on the utility poles.
All right. Thanks so much, Sam, for getting us started here. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about this fire season and the current concerns in the state and advising folks to be careful, be cautious with your outdoor activities. On the line with us is Beth Ibsen, Public Affairs Specialist with the BLM Fire Service, Rick Toman, an Alaska Climate Specialist with UAF, and Sam Harrell is a Public Information Officer with the Alaska Division of Forestry and Fire Protection. Rick, I want to turn to you here now. You noted that the interior had below normal rainfall this spring. Temps were cool, but things really changed in June. We were on air early this spring talking to folks, advising, you know, you have to be really careful, especially in South Central, because we had such low snowfall. There was such concern here. And then, you know, fortunately, South Central has not seen much fire activity yet. But boy, other parts of the state, it sure changed quickly. Talk about what happened.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. So, yeah, we were concerned early on about South Central because of the very early snow melt. But, you know, fire takes two things. You need fuels ready to burn, and then you need that spark. And fortunately, in South Central, we didn't get that second of those necessary ingredients. Different story in the interior, where for most areas, snowpack at the end of the winter was near or even above normal. Snow melt occurred over most of the interior about normal time, late April, early May, depending where you were. But since snow melt, precipitation has been well below normal. Not everywhere. As Sam mentioned, there have been thunderstorms around. Locally, they've dumped a lot of rain. But overall, since the ground cleared of snow, rainfall's been below normal. And even though it was cool in late May and the first week of June, relative humidities were also very low. And that allowed the ground to dry, the fire fuels on the ground. And of course, that organic layer, that duff layer, was also able to dry because of those low relative humidities. So though the temperatures were below normal, the air was dry. And then we had the dramatic and very rapid change to hot temperatures, high temperatures going from the 60s to the 80s in 2 days, and a really dramatic lightning outburst. We had more than 50,000 lightning strikes detected by the BLM Lightning Detection Network in 5 days between June 16 and 20. We actually have to go back to 2016 to find that many strikes in the state in 5 days. So we had fuels that were dry, and then we got the spark from the thunderstorms and the lightning, and that kicked things off. You know, it's hard to remember now, but Actually, we had the lowest amount of acreage burned in AICC analysis for the first half of June, only 38 acres. That's the lowest in the past 30 odd years. We certainly made up for it the last half of the month.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. Rick, was it 2015 or 2016, you just said, that was an unusually big year for lightning, something like 75,000 strikes? What were the conditions that year, and were they similar this spring?
So both 2015 and 16 both had extreme lightning multi-day events. It was the 2015 one, the June 2015, almost the same week in June as this year. But that was a different spring. That was an extremely warm spring. We had very early snow melt across the interior. And then the basically solstice week in 2015, we had something of order 75,000 lightning strikes. So 1.5 times what we had 10 days ago now. It was broadly similar in that we had dry fuels and lots of lightning, but the spring of 2015, very different than this spring.
As I noted in the open, Rick, 80s are in the forecast this week, but maybe there's some relief possibly arriving next week, cooler temps and rain. What are you seeing?
That's certainly possible. Certainly looks like very warm high pressure aloft is building in. Will be warm, will be dry. The good news is will not be as thundery as 10 days ago, as Sam mentioned. It does look like that big high pressure will break down. I'm not ready to declare the season done though. We really want to see those westerly winds aloft break through into the interior to bring that cooler, moister bearing sea air all the way into the eastern interior. And we don't see that on the horizon yet. So we've got a long way to go in fire season.
Well, darn it. Beth, turning to you now, reflect on how this year so far stacks up against other years that saw evacuations. You mentioned 2019 in an earlier interview. How did that year compare to this spring?
So while it's not uncommon to see a surge of lightning-caused fires over several days following hot and dry weather in Alaska, some experienced fire managers that I've talked to that have worked in fires for decades said that this year feels a little different because we had things going on in different parts of the state at the same time. It seemed like, you know, in previous years, like 2019, we had evacuations in different areas of the state, but there was a little lull in between. It was like we could kind of address one fire, get things kind of steady and get a response and things in place, and then maybe have a little break in between. We moved on to the next situation where there was a new fire with evacuations. And this year, it all happened in a very short time frame. It seemed that we were having evacuations or some kind of a alert happening almost simultaneously in different parts of the state. We had the Bear Creek near Healy, the fire Toke with evacuations, and then of course here northern, and we're here in Fairbanks, the Himalaya Haystack area, it seemed like there wasn't much break in between them. And then we even have the fire, the Ptarmigan complex in Central, where there was a fire that was very close to the community there, between two roads that was happening. I think that was the first one, or it was happening in the mix. So it was all kind of happening at once. That's why it feels so unusual. That, and a lot of these fires were basically in people's backyards. People were calling in saying, the fire is right here. Meanwhile, our resources, we were sending smoke jumpers, scoopers in different places, helitack. There are a lot of firefighters support people going in different directions. So as things were coming in, or as reports were coming in, it was the prioritization was happening really rapidly.
Looking at the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center dashboard this morning was pretty eye-opening. It lists 309 confirmed fires so far in 2025. 191 are active. But the amount of acreage burned caught my eye, nearly 350,000 acres. That sounds like a lot before the start of July. Today's the first, is it?
You have to compare in past years and what we end up with, because we're not, it's not over yet. We have that hot, dry, and the hot, dry forecast. And plus, we're also concerned about holdover fires, which is what we name fires that, with the lightning that went through, the lightning event that went through, it went through a large swath of Alaska, not just here interior, but there's northeastern part of the state also had a large amount of lightning. And while it may not initially start a fire, we have that deeper duff layer of decomposing leaves and twigs that it can kind of smolder underneath there. And as things dry out and get hotter with that 80 degree weather, we could, and if it gets a little wind on it, it could pop up with new fires. So while we have 347,000 acres burned now, and some of these remote locations that have seen lightning, we could get a lot more fires in remote locations, and that could really bump up the acreage. Now, just to remind you, our record fire season was 2004. There's probably still a lot of people in Alaska that remember that year, because we had 6.6 million acres burned. And that was a very, very long fire season. And then we've had other years where we were looking on track. I think 2022, we had an early fire season, we had big fires, and we were on track to maybe get up in those numbers. And then all of a sudden we had those southwestern flow come in, and we have a lot of moisture, and all of a sudden our fire season takes a nosedive. It's hard to predict that farther weather patterns farther out. So we're still in the early season. It's early July. We could potentially still have a lot more fire season to go, and you could really see those numbers change.
We know that usually early in the spring, fires are human caused. And then as weather gets warmer and interior, and we see all that dramatic lightning strike, that's what causes a lot of fires. You mentioned that people were calling saying, the fire is right here, it's nearly in our backyard. Have there been many human caused fires this year, or have they been primarily because of all that dramatic lightning activity?
You know, we've had our typical spate of human-caused fires. Those are our early season fires. As the snow goes away and people are cleaning up their yards and just that general spring cleaning that goes on. And typically, these are the debris piles that get away from folks, burn barrels that get away from folks, and campfires that just aren't put out. And people are a little lackadaisical coming out of the winter. They're really not paying attention. They get distracted tending a burn pile, tending a burn barrel, and it spreads into a grassy yard. And that time of year, all of those fine fuels are very dry, very susceptible to catching that fire. And that is our early season cause of fires. And like Rick was saying, you know, we were very low on our acreage there in the middle of June, and then just things took off due to lightning. And that's usually the cause of our greatest acreage, where we may have more human caused fires than naturally caused fires. But because Alaska's a large space with wide open areas, we have the opportunity to allow fire to take its natural course. It's important for Alaska's boreal forest ecology. And fires have been occurring for millennia across Alaska, just in this same fashion. But now here we are with our wilderness and urban interfaces, where we really can't let fires grow, especially when they're near our populated areas, like the ones that we have here around Fairbanks and Tok and across the interior. But in the further reaches of Alaska, they can grow and be just a threat to a cabin or two, a trapping cabin, maybe a lodge. And we do point protection to protect those areas, but let fire take its natural course. It's really going to depend on what the weather holds for us in July. our large acreage years, the greatest growth in acreage was in July. And if it's a very dry, hot July, we can certainly see an increase in acreage, just not from the fires that we already have on the landscape, but new ones that can start, and holdovers from recent lightning. We're finding a few fires each day that were caused by lightning strikes previous a few days ago, even longer, that just kind of smoldered. But now that the days are getting warmer, a little light breeze on them, and they're kindling into fires that we're discovering.
All right. Thanks for that, Sam. Rick, turning back to you, the first heat advisory that ever happened was released in Alaska in early June. It made headlines all over the place, but it wasn't because the heat had reached some level not ever seen before in the past, but it was because heat advisories just didn't exist before now, correct?
That's correct. Until June 2nd, the National Weather Service in Alaska did not issue heat advisories. Obviously, it's gotten hot many times before, and the way that the Weather Service handled that would be, in addition to the forecast, to put out a special statement or a public information statement describing the expected conditions. As of June 2nd, the Fairbanks and Juneau offices now have the dissemination mechanisms in place to issue heat advisories. Now, this is something that has been going on in the lower 48 for quite some time. And this is part of the Weather Service's recognition of the importance of extreme heat on human health and societal activity. So in some ways, the first heat advisory for Alaska was simply starting to bring Alaska into what the National Weather Service was doing. During the heat event, there were only a couple of daily record highs set. The duration was longer than some, but again, nothing we haven't seen many times before. It's this administrative change that is a recognition of the importance of heat that allowed the Weather Service Forecast Office in Fairbanks to issue this inaugural heat advisory.
And so in the future, what do you see this assisting with? What will these heat advisories help trigger?
Well, I think a main benefit of this is will be just to call people's attention to this heat, rather than a generic special weather statement or public information statement that could be about anything. And now we have a specific way to call out heat, both extreme high temperatures for a day, and within that, of course, then it can be covered. Well, we expect this to go on for days. Now, of course, in Alaska, the thresholds for this are much lower than in the lower 48. But we all know why that we need that. One, we're acclimated to lower temperatures. Our buildings are designed to hold heat. And then, of course, wildfire smoke complicates the issues when you have to keep your house buttoned up to keep the smoke out. The heat just accumulates very quickly. Mm. So our thresholds are very different than they are in the lower 48, but that's because we're very different.
Yes, we are. We have an email from Randall who says he can't get reliable information. He says, I'm currently in a level 2 evacuation area sandwiched between the Aggie Creek fire and the Himalaya fires. He writes, I saw the huge fire front of the Aggie from the highway last night, but the online situation reports I have relied on for years, fire.ak.blm.gov, has been taken down, he writes. Online attempts to get information is an overwhelming bunch of clickbait junk that goes nowhere. Most online links are just overwhelming, unreliable dead ends. I have no idea what's going on with the fire that was roaring just a few miles from me last night. We're totally blind and uninformed out here. Why in this information age am I completely uninformed? So, Beth and Sam, please jump in here and help Randall understand where he should go to get updates on the fires that he's concerned about.
Okay. Well, there's actually quite a few sources of information. I know that the AICC site has the email, the site has changed addresses over the in the last couple of years, but AK Fire Info is where we push out statewide fire information. And the AICC site is another good source of information. There's maps on there under I'm going to give you the address. It's fire.ak.blm.gov. And the map page, there's quite a few number of map products on there. They're interactive. They're also mobile friendly. One of my favorite is the Alaska Wildland Fire Information Map. And you can actually zoom in if you have the coordinates of, say, your cabin or of your house. You can enter the coordinates into a search bar, and it will drop a pin on that coordinate, and then you can zoom in or out and measure the distance between a fire and that coordinate. The situation, there's a dashboard, a situation dashboard, where it lists all of you can it has a map where you can see all the fire dots of where all the fires are. It has statistics on it. That is new this year. It's the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center situation dashboard. Of course, AK Fire Info, and we also have people that answer phones. Live people, it's not a recorded line. The Alaska Interagency Fire Information line, it is 907-356-5511. And we have when we get to a an act when we get active fire season, a lot of times we will activate what is called a joint information center, where we bring in additional public information people that are answering the phones and answering questions. The boroughs that do the evacuations, they push out a lot of information. The Fairbanks North Star Borough Emergency Operations has an interactive map that shows the different evacuation levels, and you can actually enter your address in a search bar at the top left corner, and it will zero in on your address and show whether you are in an evacuation zone. And there's, of course, the three different evacuation levels: the level one ready, which means that there's concern, there's an active wildfire in your area, and be prepared, start thinking about what to gather in case you need to evacuate suddenly. The set, which is like, but have your bags checked, have your valuables with you, have that plan in place. And then, of course, the go, meaning you need to evacuate for your safety. So
Absolutely.
there's a lot of resources out there. It's just a matter of finding them. But that AICC site is a really good site because there's a lot of information on there, whether it's about fire weather or the maps.
We are going to take a break here in just a moment, but again, for folks, if you're searching for that site, it's AICC is the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center, correct, Beth? And
Yes.
please give us the URL for the Bureau of Land Management Fire, because I tried to click on the link that Randall had sent. He had fire.ak.blm.gov. I clicked on the link he sent, and yeah, it was
Yeah,
a bad
I'm not
page.
sure what site he's referring to, because I that must be a very old site.
So
But it's the AK Fire Info. You can actually, if you go to AK Fire Info, that is the easiest one to remember. And a lot of times you can kind of use that as the jump board to other sites.
okay,
And then
and we'll
the AICC site is fire.ak.blm.gov. That's probably the one that he is thinking of.
Yeah, I'm sure that is it. And hopefully we'll link to those on the Talk of Alaska post too after the show concludes today. So hopefully Randall can get some good information. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue discussing fires of concern currently and what the future outlook may be as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the fire season and current concerns as we rapidly approach the 4th of July. On the line with me today is Beth Ibsen. Beth is a public affairs specialist with the BLM Fire Service. Rick Toman is a climate specialist at UAF. And Sam Harrell is a public information officer with the Alaska Division of Forestry and Fire Protection. Sam, you were talking earlier about how in some areas fire just is allowed to burn. It's part of the ecology of the forest. But what is making your work harder now and more challenging? Is it because of changing climate conditions or people building more into wilderness areas?
Well, that's a tough question, Lori. Probably more building in wilderness areas. There is a notable change in the weather. I haven't been in Alaska long, just a little over 30 years. And I do notice a difference in how the annual weather plays out. But just as soon as you think we're headed into a trend, here comes the next season, and it's totally askew of what you thought you were headed to. Rick is really more of an expert on this, but we are, it is that urban wilderness interface and more realization of the threat that fire has to our populated areas. And lightning has just seemed to really seek that out this year.
Rick, turning to you and realizing that it's hard to talk in terms of normal, does what was considered our normal season still tend to be fire ramping up in May and June, then dying back in July and August as the rainy part of the year starts?
Well, that certainly is a reasonable generalization, but we've certainly seen, especially in, you know, the last decade, how that can change. You know, really a big learning season for me was just 2 years ago. In 2023, we had hardly any fire in the interior through the middle of July, you know, like the lowest in the modern era kind of thing. And then we had an 18,000 lightning strike day on July 24th. And while much of the state had a wet summer in 2023, that wasn't the case in the central interior. And we went from nothing to a lot of wildfire compared to nothing in the central interior. And we wound up with days worth of thick smoke in the Fairbanks area. The total acreage burned wasn't a lot, but it almost all came at a time of year when we would not have expected that at all. So certainly our environment is showing us that generalizations are great and they're useful, but nature can do things that are very different from our expectations.
Absolutely. Beth, talk about holdover fires, and Sam had mentioned those a bit earlier, and your concern about them this year. You had said in a previous interview that the Minto Flats fire was possibly a holdover?
Yes, there hasn't been any lightning detected, and within, like, it was something like 12 days prior to that fire popping up. And this was in an area that was well traveled by aircraft, and nobody had reported anything. And when they went look back for on the lightning detection records, there wasn't any lightning in that area for a 10-day period before the fire popped up. And that is certainly the concern going into this next period of the summer, especially with the deeper ground layers getting a little bit warmer, drier as the summer progresses, and some of those fires may pop up. And I do want to kind of piggyback on some of the information that, you know, Sam was talking about, that you know, with this wildland urban interface, and we seem to be in the thick of it this year. And our top priority is always going to be public and firefighter safety. So that's why when new fires are threatening, you know, people, homes, and communities, that gets the highest response. So when we've got property and lives at stake, we're going to fight fires aggressively with always the safety at the forefront. And then in populated areas where the situations are that, you know, we're going to be responding to those areas, and maybe there's a fire that is in a less densely populated or maybe in outlying areas that would naturally get a response. But because we're concentrating on keeping people safe and communities safe, they may not get a response right away. You know, some of those far off flung places where you might have recreational cabins in remote places on a lake, that may, because we're trying to protect those communities, they may not get that response right away until we free up some resources or we free up some people. So that's why it's so important that firefighters can't do in 30 minutes what landowners have not done for 30 years. That FireWise principles, we call them FireWise principles, is make sure your property can not only is not just defensible, but survivable, because Alaska is huge. Sometimes it takes 32 hours for firefighters to get out to respond. So that's why it's very important to make sure that you take those steps to make your property, like I said, not just defensible, but survivable when there's a wildfire.
Yeah, really an important point. Thank you. You noted that the Himalaya fire activity was increasing at 2 a.m. Talk about why that's unusual for fire behavior.
Well, I can talk a little bit about that because I spent part of the day out with Chena Hotshots. It was their day 14 on the fire, and they were out on that fire probably on day 3, and they were working well into the morning hours and reporting that fire activity was picking up at 2 a.m. in the morning. Now, here in Alaska, we have a lot of sunlight that you don't see in the lower 48. But they said that was even usual because typically fire lays down in the morning hours, early morning hours, but it just wasn't happening. And I've even talked to other people that have said the fire behavior in the recent years has become more unpredictable than say they've seen in the past. We've got a smoke jumper chief here that's been fighting fire for 30 years. And he said it's, you know, sometimes what they thought that would occur, that the fire would behave, just didn't happen. So like I said, it always points down to, because of this, please, please, please take those steps to make your property safer.
Rick, reflecting on what Beth just said about, you know, the difference in how fire behaves, how are you thinking about that going forward and what that may mean? Some of it is just anomalies from year to year, but how much of this do you think is because of the changes that are happening so rapidly in the climate here and what that may portend for the future?
Yeah, so certainly, you know, especially, you know, now, you know, we're within a few weeks of summer solstice, the very long days. And, you know, the overnight burning, you know, some of that is being driven by the fuels are just drier as we're losing snow earlier as we dry those fuels. Or in this, as we saw this year, we didn't lose the snow particularly early, but we kept those very low humidities that allowed those fuels to dry. And with our very long days, even in the middle of the night with very dry fuels and fire on the ground, you get a little bit of wind and things can burn. So certainly our changing environment is going to increase the frequency of these, what we used to think of as very unusual or hardly ever happen, are going to become more common. Of course, they won't happen with every fire. But when we've got extra dry fuels and got some winds, we're within a few weeks of solstice, this kind of thing is going to happen.
2022, there was a lot of tundra fire in the southwest part of the state. Rick, what are the conditions in that region this year currently?
So that the southwest portion of the state, that was another area in the spring we were very concerned about. Much of the Bristol Bay region, for instance, had no durable snow cover this winter at low elevation at all. And so much like South Central, primed for an early season if we could get the spark. But like South Central, there just has not been much thunderstorm activity in the far southwest portion of the state. And here recently, there has been more rain. May was also wet in much of Southwest Alaska as well. So again, we need all those ingredients to come together to produce those really extreme years like 2022. This year we had one piece of it, but we didn't get that at spark.
Well, that's good. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue finding out what we all need to know to keep property and family safe through July and through this summer fire season as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Sam, the Division of Forestry suspended burn permits south of the Alaska Range. Why are burn permits in South Central suspended when we've really not had any much for any fire activity here?
Not necessarily due to fire danger, but due to the draw of resources from our southern forestry areas to the north here. We also had a lot of cooperators join us, firefighters from volunteer fire departments and other agencies. J-Bear sent firefighters, Municipal of Anchorage sent firefighters, Matsu Borough, Kenai Borough. We had a lot of help and a lot of folks responding north, and we just didn't want to have to deal with those very preventable human caused fires.
Sure.
It takes a prevention officer, it takes an engine, it usually takes a volunteer fire department or community fire engine to respond to those. And we really wanted to focus our efforts on the multiple fires that were across the interior. Weather has moderated and many of those suspensions have been lifted. Matsu is still in place, but the Kenai Kodiak area, it's been lifted. Copper River, Valdez Copper River area, it's been lifted. And also just due to the rain that's been in eastern interior, the Delta and Delkin-Tok areas, the permits have been, the suspension has been rescinded in those areas also. We still need people to be careful and to not leave their burn permits, their burn piles and such unattended.
Right.
We have the burn permit program in place that explains the best practice to conduct this. And there are other alternatives. There's a lot of woody debris disposal sites across our populated areas, and it's a much safer and easier way to rid yourself of clearing trees and the brush that's generated from that. If you're going after the firewood, you still have all that limbs and such that you need to get rid of, and just general yard maintenance and such is sometimes problematic. And if you can go to a site where it takes that, it's just much safer to be able to rid yourself of that woody debris.
It makes excellent compost and also other ways
does.
Of holding moisture in the soil. So Sam and Beth, both of you, we all know what Friday is. The 4th of July kicks off a whole weekend of people celebrating their freedom to blow things up, which will likely start on Thursday night. How do you prepare for the 4th? Do you have extra staff on standby? Are there folks in the lower 48 that are sort of queued up and ready to come if things get out of hand?
You know, it's a challenge to get people from the lower 48 here that quick. We have multiple fire crews up here, additional smoke jumpers, additional firefighting aircraft. Those assets are already in Alaska and in place. And 4th of July is always a watch out situation for fire. And we are being more diligent about patrols out looking for what's going on. Mm-hmm. In the Fairbanks North Star Borough, they have suspended the use of fireworks this season. And it hasn't really happened in other municipalities in Alaska. It comes down to the local municipalities and what it is they want to do for the 4th. But in the North Star Borough, they have suspended fireworks for this upcoming holiday?
Fireworks are not legal in Anchorage, but it still sounds like a war zone in my neighborhood every 4th of July and a few days before and a few days after. What should people do to help protect their urban property from some knucklehead's bottle rocket? Should they be thinking about keeping the sprinklers on, watering their trees and lawn? What should they do in the city?
That's a good start, you know, and that just it all goes back to, we live in a fire prone state and we need to start the fire season ready. And you have your yard cleaned up, you don't have leaves under the deck, your firewood is stored well away, and just sprinklers keeps everything damp. It's not so susceptible to a spark. It raises the humidity in the immediate area of your property, and it helps keep everything green, so it's not so susceptible to a spark. There's no easy answer to this. Fireworks are readily available, and people feel empowered and want to use them and enjoy them. I'm certainly of the fan to enjoy them in the winter when it's dark and you can see them, but that's just my opinion. So,
yeah, they're great for celebrating New Year's Eve rather than the 4th of July. Beth, earlier you were talking about defensible and survivable space around homes, especially in rural areas. How big of an area is a good amount to be cleared for safe space, realizing that wind and other conditions can change how far and fast a fire can spread? But is there some sort of good average clearance zone for a property?
Well, there's kind of a checklist within the 15 feet of your structure. Just remove all conifers, all that spruce trees or dead vegetation. Edge your home, your buildings with small plants, flowers, or even better, rocks or gravel. And then as you get 15 to 30 feet away, thin your conifer trees, limb them up. Don't have those low-lying limbs because they're called, it's considered a ladder, where if you have a ground fire, if you have low-hanging limbs, it could easily catch those on fire. And for that black spruce, it quickly, you know, goes up. It sounds like it goes up with a whoosh. So try and limb up your trees and space them apart. If you have a pretty thick cluster, maybe remove some of the trees. You don't have to remove all of them because they do provide shade, but have them spaced apart to where their branches aren't touching each other. Another thing too is remove shrubs beneath the trees, remove all that dry vegetation. Another thing too is clean out your gutters, because sometimes the main fire isn't what gets a structure. It's embers carrying on the wind, and that gets trapped underneath porches. Say if you have a bunch of woody debris underneath your porch, or you keep your firewood on there, move it from out from underneath your porch, put it away from your house, because you know, some of those embers can get caught underneath there and catch things on fire, and you definitely don't want that, because if you have a fire starting underneath your porch, that can easily spread to your house. Mm. And maybe put mesh over your vents so the embers don't fly into your eaves, underneath your eaves. There's just little things that you can do. The FireWise booklet, there's a booklet online that has some really good tips on what you can do, but that 15 to 30 feet, that's kind of the zone where you want to have those measures in place. It's very important.
We've seen horrific examples in recent years of urban wildfire devastation in Hawaii and California. How are you all thinking about that for Alaska communities? Anchorage is a cool place to live primarily because of all the urban forest areas, but it's also dangerous, especially with so much standing dead spruce. What do fire managers, what are the conversations about what that should look like going forward for populated areas?
Well, it's very important. I know there's been a lot of effort, especially in recent years, to put in say fire breaks or fuel breaks, where you've created kind of this buffer where I know if it, there a lot of them are shaded fuel breaks where you're clearing out some of that dense trees. And then of course with the spruce beetle outbreak in recent years, I know the Campbell Track has, they've removed some of those hazardous trees where not only are there fire hazard, but they create a hazard for people that try and enjoy the trails out there. So they're not falling on people on the out of nowhere. So there's a lot of good work going on, but there's still a lot left to do. And that's where it's good for people to take their steps on that property, because we can only do so much. It's one of those things where we're all working together to try and make the community safer, but it also takes a community participation, people's participation. I know there's been a lot of meetings in Anchorage lately, and the Anchorage Fire Department stood up a wildland fire division. The person who's heading that actually used to work for Division of Forestry and Fire Protection and is well known, and he's very well experienced in that. John Glover is his name. So it's, like I said, it takes a community's involvement. It's not just pulling it on the fire departments or us as protection agencies. It takes all of us working together.
Well, and in that light, taking all of us working together, how much do citizens get involved to help with actual fires? I was thinking back earlier to many, many years ago. My late husband and my sister went off to volunteer to fight a big fire in Wisconsin. I couldn't because I was pregnant. That's how long ago it was. But the DNR in Wisconsin issued big water cans on backpacks with hand sprayers for volunteers. Does that still happen? Do citizens get enlisted to help out in that way?
You know, that's really not such the case anymore. We see where people resist the evacuation go now notices, thinking that they're going to stay behind and defend their property. And honestly, firefighters know that people are in there and they're concerned for those lives that are exposed to the dangers of a wildland fire, and they're not focusing on stopping a wildland fire. The best thing you can do is to prepare your property ahead of time, be ready to evacuate before you're called to evacuate, have your plan in place, and quite honestly, that's the best way to help the firefighters. Firefighters, they want to save, they want to help people, and it can be a distraction when you're trying to defend a neighborhood from fire and you know that there's people in there whose lives are at risk.
Such an important note to end on. Thank you so much, Sam, that people should really listen to those evacuation orders when it says go, and keep yourself safe and alive, and firefighters as well. Thanks so much to my guest today, Beth Ibsen, Public Affairs Specialist with the BLM Fire Service, Rick Toman, who is an Alaska and Arctic Climate Specialist with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at the International Arctic Research Center at UAF, and Sam Harrell, Public Information Officer with the Alaska Division of Forestry and Fire Protection. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Sam Lang helped us out today, and also thanks to Eliza Dunn, who also helped us with today's program. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.